We seek a strong finish to our current fiscal year. Call 217-244-9455 or go to willpledge.org to make your gift today. And thanks.
This is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Audie Cornish. Michelle Martin is away. We'll begin today by taking a look at the big political stories out of Washington and around the country. President Obama said yesterday at the White House briefing that he is prepared to send up to 300 military advisors to Iraq to support Iraqi security forces in their fight against ISIS. Here's the president.
American forces will not be returning to combat in Iraq, but we will help Iraqis as they take the fight to terrorists who threaten the Iraqi people, the region, and American interests as well.
Joining us to tell us more about this and other political developments is Corey Elans. He's a former White House communications staffer with the Obama administration and currently with Vox Global, a Washington, D.C.-based public affairs firm. He's with us here in our Washington, D.C. studios. Hey there, Corey.
Hello.
And also joining us is Amy Holmes. She's anchor of the Hot List at TheBlaze.com, and she's with us from our New York City bureau. Amy, how are you?
Very well. Thanks for having me.
So I'm going to start with you and the president's remarks on Iraq. Many are calling his actions a kind of middle ground, right, against a more in between a more aggressive military action, which I guess at this point people are talking about airstrikes, and no action at all.
Yeah, I called it the Goldilocks solution, which is, the American public is certainly war-weary. We don't want to send combat troops, boots on the ground, into this Middle East conflagration. But our national security is at stake here. We're seeing terrorists on the march, moving toward Baghdad, potentially creating a terrorist state from which to launch attacks. And I think that the president, after a bit of hemming and hawing, seems to have come around to that same conclusion.
Corey Elans, Sunni militant extremists definitely being really taking back some ground where even al-Qaeda couldn't seem to make it in northern Iraq. Can you talk a little bit about what you feel that the president has done here?
Well, I tell you, let's put aside for the moment the fact that Vice President Cheney seems to be misremembering the facts on how we got into this war in the first place. You really do have to appreciate the president's incremental approach to making sure that we're moving in the right direction in Iraq. And there's one person who is responsible for what's happening there right now, and that's Nouri al-Maliki, on two quick points. First, Nouri al-Maliki has not governed from a position that really enveloped the entire country, bringing in Sunnis, Shia, and Kurds.
We should say he's the prime minister of Iraq and a Shia in leaning.
Exactly right. He's a Shia Muslim. And so from that perspective, even people within who are Shias do not support him right now, and his support is eroding. That's in part, that's a part of the reason why things are not doing well there. The other piece is the reason we don't have forces on the ground right now in Iraq is in part because we don't have a status of forces agreement, and that's because we couldn't get Maliki to agree to the terms of a status of forces agreement when we were attempting to negotiate this
if
before
I could interject,
2011.
If sure. I could interject, Dexter Filkins has covered this pretty extensively and reported that, in fact, our negotiators on the ground with the Iraqi government, with Mr. Maliki, didn't know where our White House stood. And in fact, that President Obama said that, or basically felt that bringing our troops completely out of Iraq was one of his greatest foreign policy successes. What we're seeing right now is the consequence of that, which is without U.S. forces, some residual force there to keep the peace, we're seeing terrorists on the march. And I would like to add that the leader of ISIS, that's the terrorist group that is taking over those regions of Iraq, he actually, when he was released from custody in 2009, said, quote, "I will see you in New York." This is a direct threat to American national security, to American lives. And I do appreciate that the president, after listening to his advisors, understands that there does need to be an American presence, however residual there, to keep the peace.
Amy, I want to jump in here because I think you're both getting at an issue, which is people are rehashing the decision-making that led us here. We've certainly in recent...
But I think that's a mistake.
I don't think we need to rehash how we got here.
I think we need to address where we are.
But my point is that people are talking about it, right? You have Dick Cheney with an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal. You have people like Paul Wolfowitz, former Deputy Defense Secretary, talking out there. Paul Bremer, even, who actually led the provisional authority governing Iraq after the U.S. invasion. Now, interesting, in the press conference yesterday, President Obama actually alluded to the past here. Here's a clip.
What's clear from the last decade is the need for the United States to ask hard questions before we take action abroad, particularly military action.
Corey Elans, I want to give you a chance to reply to some of Amy's points, but also to this idea of, really we're hearing politicians hash out this thinking all over again. Which decision led us to this point?
Well, I tell you, the main thing that we should be focused on, again, I agree, is the right now. And you have two former Bush officials who are basically in that same space, David Petraeus, who we know led forces in that arena during the escalation in the Gulf War, has basically said, or in the Iraq War, said as of yesterday, we need to be thoughtful and cautious as we enter this engagement. Michael Gerson, a columnist for The Washington Post, has said just today that President Obama is taking the right approach in this incremental assessment prior to committing any forces in Iraq. And let's be clear, the president has said just yesterday that we want to make sure that if it's determined, based on our assessment, that an immediate American threat is there, that we will be in a position to take action. And so all the options are on the table except putting boots on the ground. And that's what's important here.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about some of the big political stories out of Washington. Joining us is former White House staffer Corey Elans and Amy Holmes of The Blaze. And Amy, I just want to give the last word on this topic to you.
Well, I don't think that it's sort of useful or productive to be rehashing the past. I agree with Corey, as we said, that we need to consider where we are now as Americans and our national security interests when it comes to the Middle East and this conflagration in Iraq. I appreciate that the president is sending 300 troops there as advisors to hopefully push back this terrorist threat. You know, we will see what unfolds.
Now, also from the White House, they're announcing that they're going to extend federal benefits granted under Social Security, veterans programs, the Family Medical Leave Act, and more to same-sex couples. And, of course, this is a result of the Supreme Court's repeal of the Defense of Marriage Act last June. And what people are noting here is that this is extending federal benefits, obviously, to same-sex couples, no matter where they live. Amy, just to come to you again one more time, there are so many states right now where they had a ban, essentially, on same-sex marriage. And that ban is under challenge. Does this affect that atmosphere at all?
I think it does. And I think that this decision actually makes a lot of sense, that if you're legally married in one state but you move to another, I think you should still be regarded as a married couple, at least under federal law. But I also understand the federalist argument that marriage is something that should be decided by the states. But I think when it comes to same-sex marriage, that, you know, there has been a tectonic shift in public opinion and more acceptance, which I applaud.
And Corey, what do you make of this decision coming at this point in time?
I agree. I think it is a decision that is well-timed. And it's been interesting to watch the president's evolution on this issue of gay rights and gay marriage in particular. If you think back to previous presidents, Truman and Eisenhower, and their evolution on the issues associated with civil rights in the African-American community, they did what they could with what they had at the moment, taking incremental steps to get us to the right place. And they took their actions primarily with the military. So I think this is a good move for the president, and I think that it bodes well for more to come.
Of course, we're also in the midst of election season. When are we not?
When are we not? That's right.
It's always election
ever
season.
Present.
So two
That's
topics
right.
for you guys. One, we're going to talk poll numbers, President Obama, and two, congressional races, things we should look forward to. So let's start with those poll numbers. A recent NPR poll shows that President Obama's approval numbers in key Senate battleground states is lower than his national approval numbers. The poll showed that in the 12 states with competitive races, just 38% of voters approve of how the president is doing his job. Corey, come on. They've got to be worried.
They are. But I tell you, 9 of those 12 states, those battleground states, are states that he lost in the last election anyway to Mitt Romney. So it's no surprise that his numbers are going to be lower there than they would be nationally. That's appreciated. I think what's more interesting about these recent polls is the dramatic lows that Congress has reached. Right now, the Pew poll recently, out this just this week, has Congress at a 7% approval rating.
Yeah, but it's Congress.
It is
always
Congress.
Low.
Congress is
but what
never
it's,
popular.
What that speaks to, though, is that the American people as a whole are dissatisfied with leadership here in Washington, whether it's the president in the White House or whether it's members of Congress.
Amy?
The president is looking at a very bad landscape here. And there was also the NBC Wall Street Journal poll out this week that found that 54% of the public doesn't believe that this president has what it takes to lead for the next 2.5 years. So to the extent that midterm elections are a referendum on the White House, this is very bad news for the White House and for Democrats. And as Corey said, those battleground states are states that President Obama lost to Mitt Romney by double digits. So what we're talking about is actually control of the Senate. And if Republicans take over the Senate and keep control of the House, President Obama's agenda and the Democratic agenda is basically dead in the water.
All right. 2 minutes left, so I'm making this a lightning round for both of you.
Mm-hmm. All right, I'm ready.
Looking ahead to congressional races, we're going to make this sound as exciting as we can. Amy, for you, the race you think is the one to watch?
One that's really interesting to me is Monica Wiebe. She's in Oregon. She is a Republican who is running for the United States Senate. She's a pediatric neurosurgeon, and she's running against Democratic incumbent Jeff Merkley. Now, Rasmussen has her down by 10 points, but also a very large number of Oregon voters undecided. What I think is interesting about this race is that she is pro-gay marriage. She is pro-choice. She is conservative on the fiscal issues. Also, being a doctor, she's a very sharp critic of Obamacare, which we know is very unpopular with the public.
Also, so this is she, right?
And a female. I think she should be more of a household name. I think the national media should be far more interested in her than they are. But because she's a Republican, you can't expect that.
We'll work on
but
it, Amy.
I think it's interesting. And it'll be interesting to see if Republicans can field a candidate who can win in a blue state.
All right. Corey, last word to you.
Keeping on the theme of female candidates, I'm looking at two races on the Senate side based on what Amy was just saying about that's really where the big races are this cycle because of what's at stake. Two races in particular, one in North Carolina with Kay Hagan running against Tom Tillis. Right now, that race is within the margin of error. Hagan is up 42-38, but we have big money that's about to be poured in there from Emily's List and Planned Parenthood. So it'll be interesting to see how that impacts the race, not just the money, but the messaging that goes along with that. And then always paying attention to our friend Mary Landrieu in Louisiana, who is now running more on her father's record than on the president's record, which is very interesting. And you have the possibility of, because of the way the Louisiana primary works, that's going to be decided after the general election and could possibly break the tie if there's a 50-50 split. So it'll be very, very interesting to watch.
Corey Elans, former White House communications staffer with the Obama administration, currently with Vox Global. Thanks so much for coming in.
Good to be with you.
And Amy Holmes, anchor of the Hot List at TheBlaze.com. Amy, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Just ahead, New York City's famed Riverside Church is getting a new leader, and she has some non-traditional ideas.
The gospel message is really offensive and transformational, and we need to own it again. Otherwise, we're just the Rotary Club.
Pastor Amy Butler shares her vision for the progressive church. That's coming up on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Audie Cornish.
On the next Fresh Air, novelist David Gilbert. At the center of his book, And Sons, is a reclusive novelist who has a special place in the hearts of readers, especially those who read him when they were young. But the writer's adult sons don't feel that connection. And Sons is now in paperback. Also, Kevin Whitehead pays tribute to jazz pianist Horace Silver, who died Wednesday. Join us.
Weekdays at 11 a.m. and 7 p.m. on AM 580.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Subaru of Champaign County, featuring the Subaru Impreza, with standard all-wheel drive and an EPA highway rating of 36 mpg, depending on conditions. More information is available at SubaruofChampaign.com or at their location on Route 45 in Savoy.
This is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Audie Cornish. Michelle Martin is away. Now it's time for Faith Matters. That's the part of the program where we talk about issues of religion, faith, and spirituality. The Riverside Church in New York City is one of this country's best-known churches. It has a diverse congregation and legacy of progressive political action. It's where Martin Luther King Jr. delivered his historic anti-Vietnam War speech in 1967. Despite its storied past, Riverside has been a church without a shepherd since 2009. But now, Reverend Amy Butler has been named the new senior minister of Riverside. She'll be the first woman in that post. She'll say goodbye to her flock in Washington, D.C. this weekend. And Michelle Martin caught up with her shortly after she was voted into her new position by the congregation. She began by asking the Reverend why she wanted to be a minister.
I have always been interested in the church. It's been something that I've loved since I was a young child. I was raised in the church. And when I went to college, I started taking some theology courses, and I really loved them. So I took a class where I did a ministry internship at a local church. It was a conservative church, and I was there with six other men for the summer on the staff. At the end of the summer, they ordained all the men, and they gave me a certificate of appreciation. And it was sort of in that moment that I thought, huh, I bet I could do what they're doing. In fact, I have, and I'd like to continue. And that was sort of where things were born for me, and I decided to go to seminary, and that's how the journey started.
Within your tradition, you are a Baptist, correct? Well, you're ordained in the Baptist tradition, and we know that there are different opinions about women in leadership. Was this a struggle for you?
Right. I grew up in a very conservative tradition where I never saw women in the pulpit at all. So when I went to college, it was liberating and sort of rebellious to become a Baptist, you know, and I just loved the Baptist idea that the Spirit of God could show up and work wherever she wanted to work. And so when I decided to go into ministry, I thought, this is going to be great. Everyone's going to go for it. And no, not so much.
Not so much, but you stuck with it.
I stuck with it, and we have congregational polity, so each church can make their own decisions about whom they ordain. And so I found some wonderful communities of faith along the way that really just supported me and encouraged me to keep going.
So you were elected to your current position, where you're also a senior pastor. You are an unusual figure for that pulpit, as it has been traditionally understood. I mean, you are a single mom of three. You have been a pastor of a church, not an academic.
Right.
You know, people like that term, public intellectual. It seems to me like all pastors are public intellectuals to a degree. But anyway, you're an academic and not a kind of a theologian per se. Why did you want that pulpit?
Well, I sent my resume in initially at the encouragement of a friend who called and told me that I should do it. And as I began talking to the folks at the Riverside Church, the prominence of that pulpit, which looms large, became less of a compelling factor than the congregation itself. I just felt a connection with the people, and I felt that they could see how I like to be a pastor and how I like to be church together, and that they really wanted to bring some of that into their community. And I just felt drawn to that.
I want to play a short clip from the sermon. You were voted into, Riverside, you were voted into this position by the congregation. It is their choice. And as I understand it from the reporting of the members, it was near unanimous. I just want to play a short clip from your candidacy sermon. Here it is.
We're often like that caged bird with clipped wings and tied feet. Why? Because we live in a society where the institutional church is becoming increasingly irrelevant. Because those of us who have spent any time in the inner workings of the institutional church can quickly lean toward despair. Because the history of the church universal has been marked by many shame-filled failures.
You know, that's actually kind of a tough message. And normally, in an interview, in a job interview, people generally don't appreciate being told what's going wrong. But you went right there. I'm curious about why you decided to do that. You're quoting Maya Angelou. Of course, you were referencing the late, great Maya Angelou, who just passed away.
Right. I thought her passing made me think about the way the church is often constrained. You know, I feel like the text guides my preaching, and Sunday was Pentecost Sunday, where the church was born, and there's no better Sunday than to express to the church again what it's called to be. And I thought, what a great gift and opportunity to share with them what I expect and anticipate.
Well, you know, to that end, though, why do you think the church is on the ropes? Some might argue that, you know, the conservative churches are alive and well. It's the liberal churches that are the ones that are on the ropes. Why do you think that is?
I think for the last 60 years, we have just skated by on societal requirements. You know, people had to go to church to be socially acceptable. That's not the case anymore. So we're not going to skate by anymore on people's feelings of guilt. We have to have a message that's compelling and a community that draws people in. And what a great opportunity for us now to think about who we are and who we want to be and to make it mean something.
It's interesting that conservative Christian religious figures loom very large in our public discourse these days in a way that liberal Christian religious figures used to but no longer do. I mean, people know the name William Sloan Kaufman. People know the name Martin Luther King Jr.,
yes.
Right?
Yes.
But these days, they're more likely, if you were to name an influential Christian religious figure, the person that they would more likely name would be, a Pat Robertson, for example.
Right.
Why do you think that is?
Well, we religious progressives and liberals have often given in to sort of a lukewarm message because we're so scared of offending anybody. You know, but the gospel message is really offensive and transformational, and it's a great message to share, and we need to own it again. Otherwise, we're just the Rotary Club.
What role do you think your gender plays in your faith message? Do you think it has any relevance today? It's noteworthy that there are, as you pointed out, you're not that old, but you're in your 40s, correct?
Yes.
And it's interesting to see the change in the time since you've been a practicing minister, and that, you know, at first it was like a fight, you know, to kind of get in the door. And now you see that many pulpits, the seminaries, there are many, many women, to the point where some are worried that, in fact, the church is becoming so feminized that men are being pushed out of it. I'm just interested in your take on what role, if any, you feel your gender plays in the way you see the world or the way you preach or the way you practice.
I feel like my gender is something that is a real advantage for me as a pastor. That feminine approach brings a softer edge maybe to the task of pastoral leadership. There are many men who are very good at this too, though. Let's be clear.
Yeah. Do you think, though, I'm curious, though, there was this one issue arose, the prior person to hold the pulpit. It has been reported that part of the reason that he left is that people were kind of offended by his salary, and they felt that he was a little too fancy, is what they felt, for the position. It's been reported that your salary is considerably less. Part of the reason I'm curious about that is that's some of the things that people worry about. They worry that when women move into leadership, that leadership becomes redefined in a way that is less prestigious, right?
Right.
It's like administrative assistants used to all be men, and then when they became predominantly women, salaries went down, and the profession became less respected as an important profession. And people feel like the same thing is happening in law and in a number of other areas as women become more prominent. Thoughts?
No, I think it's a completely fair question. And the Riverside Church was very intent on paying me equitably to make sure that, you know, there was no question about that. You know, being the first female pastor, that was also very important to me. So my salary is $250,000, which is the same salary that Dr. Braxton made. The church is paying for my housing and my retirement and, you know, my health insurance as is normal. So the two packages are not exactly the same, but I think, you know, the salaries are the same. And I think that was the important thing for me in terms of equity. And, you know, the church was very supportive of that.
Mm-hmm. So not a bad salary. Not a bad salary for a country preacher.
That's it. It's a huge salary. And I feel really humbled by it. I mean, it gives me the opportunity to think about how to be a good steward of these amazing resources I've been offered. And same is true for the church. They, you know, have many, many resources. And it's our job to think about how to use those most effectively for the gospel mission.
I am curious, though, are there any people who feel that they just want to see a man in that job? It's like the father figure. Some people, that is, in some traditions, that's the argument for why women are not in the pulpit, because they feel that the person needs to be in the image of Jesus or the image of the deity whom they perceive as male. Have you got any suggestion of that?
I have not heard one expression of that at all. People have been very welcoming and have just taken this as the next thing.
Do you mind if I mention you're also a person of color? You would. I don't know if you perceive yourself that way. As I understand it, your father is a Native Hawaiian.
Yes.
I don't know if that is also part of your sense of yourself in the world.
Oh, that has totally shaped my theology of church, because I grew up in this completely diverse environment with people from all over the world. It's a total melting pot. Have you ever been there? It's wonderful. And I get nervous when I'm in a room and everybody looks the same as I do. I think our lives are so much richer and our faith community is so much more deep and profound when we do the work of living in diverse community.
What do you hope to accomplish in this new role? How will you know that you are succeeding?
I think I'm going to know that I'm succeeding if I do good work and I love the people. My goal for this community of faith is that we come to know each other and love each other in such a way that our community is compelling and that that radiates out to the community and to the world around with the message of Jesus.
That was Reverend Amy Butler. She'll begin her post at New York City's Riverside Church this fall. We turn now to sad news from baseball. Hall of Famer Tony Gwynn died this week. He was known as one of the best hitters to ever grace the game and most certainly the San Diego Padres clubhouse. Here's former New York Yankees pitcher Mariano Rivera on what Gwynn meant to the league.
Tremendous hitter, you know, and guy that was involved in the community, you know, trying to teach the game of baseball. And that's what it is, you know, about being a role model, but just giving back. And he was one of them. And so sorry that we missed, that we lost one of the good ones.
The Padres held a special ceremony in memory of Gwynn this week, and the team will wear patches with his number, number 19, for the rest of the season. Along with the remembrances and honors for Gwynn, there are also questions about the cancer that killed him. Several sources reported that he connected the disease with his longtime use of chewing tobacco. Smokeless tobacco sales around the country are growing faster than cigarette sales. And joining us to talk about smokeless tobacco in baseball is Ted Eaves. He's an adjunct instructor of exercise science at High Point University in North Carolina. He also researches the use of tobacco in baseball. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
During his time, Tony Gwynn was known to be one of the nicest guys in the league, and his death has reminded people about how widespread, how popular smokeless tobacco use is amongst players. But you say that coaches are a big part of the problem.
Yes. What we see with the research, a lot of players obviously use it, but we're seeing similar numbers in coaches at all levels, high school, college, and in the pros. If you look at it, especially at the younger ages, is a question of role modeling. How good of a role model are they for these athletes, and are they helping to sort of entice or lead them into the habit?
So given that, how big a deal is it that the league itself, Major League Baseball, did try to make some rules to at least keep the habit out of sight? Well, how big a difference did that make?
I think we're going to see a pretty good difference. They're not allowing the players in the major leagues to use the spit tobacco or dip during interviews. They're not allowed to carry the tins onto the playing field. They still allow use in the dugouts and locker rooms and field, but they aren't supposed to have it as out there and obvious. It didn't go as far as people that are in the tobacco elimination area would prefer, but they did make some significant change, and that's going to trickle down to the younger ages because the high school athletes and the younger athletes aren't going to be shown it as prevalently as they have in the past.
Now, you spent a lot of time researching smokeless tobacco use on the high school level. What have you learned?
There have been a lot of studies done on high school athletes, and you see anywhere from about 35 to 50% use at even the JV and varsity level. And coaches, where I'd spent most of my time researching, it's anywhere from 15, 20% up to 35% use.
Give us a sense of the tobacco culture on some of these teams.
It's a strong thing. It's become a ritual almost. You see players just doing it because that's what they feel is part of baseball. It's the same thing to them as wearing batting gloves or wearing your hat a certain way or your socks a certain way. It's just they feel a part of the game. And so when you see that, it becomes really difficult to try and get it to be removed from the game because it's just something that's there. It's ingrained. And that's the hardest part of trying to break the habit is break that culture.
Remind us of the history here, the connection between smokeless tobacco and baseball.
Oh, yes. It goes back into the 1800s when they first started baseball. There was dry, dusty fields. You had your glove to keep moist, your mouth to keep moist. And so they started using tobacco then for that purpose. Used it a little bit with the spitball. You know, that was banned early in the 20s. But before that, it gave you a little bit more control and made the ball move more. And then it tapered down a little bit between then and the 70s and 80s. Smoking became a little more prevalent. And then when you see the uprise again is when we started getting the research that smoking was bad for you and the public started decreasing their use. Athletes did the same thing. And that's when the spit tobacco increased back up to what it is now.
So, Ted Eaves, what kind of rules would you like to see?
I think the best rule would be a no-use policy at the major league level, similar to what the NCAA and minor leagues have implemented, because even with not carrying the 10s onto the field and not using them during interviews, you still see close-ups of the batters' faces and the outfielders' and infielders' faces while they're there, and you see that pocket of dip. And so players know what it is, even if you're not going to carry the cans of tobacco onto the field. They know it's there, and they're going to want to be just like their favorite athletes.
Is there any chance that the death of Tony Gwynn will revive this debate?
I would hope that seeing something as traumatic as what he went through will help, but I'm not sure that one player will be enough. Unfortunately, I think it's going to have to be more, or just a tide turn in general for the players to realize that it is a safety hazard for them and then for players even at younger ages.
That's Ted Eaves. He's an adjunct instructor at High Point University in North Carolina. He studies the use of tobacco in baseball, and he joined us from member station WUNC in Durham. Ted Eaves, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Just ahead, time for a shape-up in the barbershop. The guys weigh in on the World Cup and the NBA's offseason. And which barbershop guy has his eye on the new electric Harley Davidson and is willing to admit it? That's up next here on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Audie Cornish.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Carnegie Corporation, supporting the New Americans campaign and all their partners promoting citizenship. More at greatimmigrants.carnegie.org. From the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, a source for what works in education. Learn more at edutopia.org. And from the Mosaic Foundation of Rita and Peter Hayden, based in Ann Arbor, honoring the passion of NPR journalists all around the world whose stories take us there every day. This is NPR.
Ever seen a one-wheeled electric motorcycle? You will. I'm Ira Flatow. Join me on Science Friday as we take a look at the innovative ways Portland, Oregon gets around. And roboticist turned author Daniel H. Wilson imagines the world after the robot apocalypse. All on Science Friday from PRI.
Friday afternoon at 1 on AM 580.
On Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, we make promises all the time. We just don't keep them.
Is any of the show going to air?
None. None.
I'm Peter Sagal. Tune in to hear things that none of us ever imagined saying on the radio. That's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me from NPR.
Saturday at 10 a.m. and Sunday at noon on AM 580.
Support comes from Bodywork Associates, offering professional, licensed massage therapy to Champaign-Urbana since 1982. Two locations, including inside the Activities and Recreation Center, north of Memorial Stadium on the U of I campus, and on Windsor Road in Champaign. More information is at bodyworkassociates.com.
I'm Audie Cornish, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Michelle Martin is away. Now it's time for the weekly visit to the barbershop, where the guys talk about what's in the news and what's on their minds. Sitting in the chairs for a shape-up this week are writer Jimmy Israel with us from Cleveland. Hey there, Jimmy.
Hey, AC, what took you so long, sister? Go with your intros. My bad.
Healthcare consultant and contributor to National Review Online, Neil Minkoff. He's in New York City. Neil, I don't expect a robust hello, but how are you?
Robust hello.
Okay, thanks. And nice. In here in our Washington, D.C. studio, contributing editor for The Root, Corey Dade.
Yes, sir.
And along with Ahmad Omar, he's NPR editor with Morning Edition. Hey there, Ahmad.
Yes, ma'am.
All right, Jimmy, I hear you're in charge of this.
Hey, I'm doing the best I can. First of all, before we get started, I got to shout out some people. Shout out to I know we means Kyle Williams, Jamie Dixon, Dr. Scope, Paul Cox, John Kersey, and Kristen Crane, because those are my fam. Kristen Kane, sorry, Kane. Anyway,
I feel like I should drop a hit or a remix or something after that. What is that?
In the mix.
All right, let's get to the
Welcome
World Cup
to the
here.
Shop, fellas. How we doing?
Hey, what's up?
Thank you. At NPR, the home of all your radio fun on your FM dial. So let's get things started. You know, soccer really isn't my game or match, but Ayo, Ahmad Omar here. You're feeling down about the poor English guys, the World Cup loss, man. My bad.
Yeah,
I'm sorry about that. Who are you rooting for now?
Well, you might know I was born in England, so, you know.
I did not know that.
Typical England, really, isn't it? Shambolic defending, lost track of Luis Suarez in the area.
There we go.
That's
You've
not bad.
Again on football's grandest
stage. Who let Monty Python loose in the studio?
It's disgusting. I bet. Back to American accent. That's what I feel about that, Jimmy. Any other questions, sir?
Ooh. Ouch.
Not today. C-Dade. Are you down with the cup, bro?
I am. I'm enjoying watching it. I think two things are standing out for me. For starters, Brazil, because they're hosting, the huge expectation in that country is that team takes it. They're, of course, the dominant tradition with World Cup victories. But the way they're playing right now, it's like they're forcing it. So that sort of explains they're tied to an inferior team in Mexico. But really, sort of the more interesting angle so far, and I always trip out about this, is the American media's effort to sort of hype or overhype the American soccer team. Mm-hmm. Team USA. Mm-hmm. Every year there's a World Cup or the Olympics. You know, they take any little thing and try to extrapolate it into something big. They have chances this year to really advance. Not really.
To be fair, they've gone from absolutely terrible to like kind of mediocre to okay-ish to decent-ish.
To not painful to watch. So,
which is nice.
Now, their surprise win in Ghana only sort of supports that notion. But what's interesting is if Ronaldo is actually hurt or if he doesn't play for Portugal on Sunday and the U.S. actually ties or, God forbid, wins, then, ESPN and the American media, they're just going to blow their lids. It's going to be interesting to watch.
Well, that's what it's all about. Right?
If we're awake. So, Dr. Neil, I understand you're into flopping. You got my attention, bro. Explain that one.
Yeah, well, no, it's just funny. You know, we just came off the NBA Finals, and we think of NBA players as maybe being the best athletes in the world. And then you see these soccer guys, and they're they don't sub out, and they run this gigantic field for two 45-minute stretches with very few, if any, stoppages, and they're always falling down.
Lob City.
I mean, it's much worse than the Heat. It's much worse than what's going on in the NBA because the stakes are higher. If you flop and there's a yellow card, and you flop and do it again, there's another one, then, man, you've really got an advantage. But it really turns me off as a casual fan to watch these fantastic athletes with otherwise perfect body control just collapse in a heap.
Well, to be fair, they are trying to cut down on that.
You guys are all assuming everyone knows what flopping is, all right? So flopping is when basically conveniently near the official you, manage to fall
pretend as though after some contact.
AC, real talk. I mean, that works in real life because, I had to flop. That's called insurance fraud, Jimmy.
Okay.
No, it has other applications. I had to flop during the defense of my MFA, man. You know, I was kind of running a little long. I just hit the ground gave me a mulligan.
It's also popular in basketball, right? I remember some news stories going by complaining about people flopping.
But speaking of people hitting the ground, let's talk about some real American football. Dan Snyder, owner of the Washington Redskins, that infamous team, has a new problem on his hands. He's dug in on keeping the team name, even though critics say it's a racial slur. Now the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office is upping the ante, and they're trying to hit him where it hurts. his pocketbooks. Artie?
Yeah, I mean, basically the team's been going back and forth with the patent office for a while over this. In their most recent ruling, they rescinded the team's trademark registration, saying it's, quote, disparaging to Native Americans. And, of course, the team is appealing the effort. Jimmy, what do you think of that move?
I think that it ups the ante. And I live in the home of the Cleveland Indians. And I get it and I understand it. But I'm a big fan of bigger fish to fry. And that makes me sound like an awful person. And I'll be that dude. But Jimmy Crack Corn, I'm sorry. I mean, that's where I am on that. I mean,
I don't even know what that means. I'm going to let Corey jump in.
Yeah, go ahead, C-Dave.
Do you care, though?
Yeah,
as the resident D.C. native who grew up watching this team and, you know, to the point where he became a diehard Dallas Cowboys fan, holler.
We won't hold that against you.
I got to get that in.
Like shout out Friday.
You know, what's interesting with this is that the DC fans, which is, you know, one of the most racially diverse fan bases, a huge African-American fan base, they are overwhelmingly in favor of keeping the name, but they're just tone deaf, quite frankly. You know, the DC delegate to Congress, Eleanor Holmes Norton, said it best recently. You know, she's a third generation Washingtonian, and she used the name for years, too, until she became more sensitized about the offense that people take from that name. And in America, we have, when it comes to racial slurs, we have a rule. We have a custom, and it's codified by law. The target of the name gets to decide if that name is offensive. Full stop. So it doesn't matter if Dan Snyder thinks it's offensive. It doesn't matter how many justifications the NFL gives about it honoring Native Americans, which is really BS. The bottom line is it is offensive to a large number of people, and for some people, it is analogous to the N-word.
I want to make room for Dr. Neil here, the libertarian.
Absolutely.
Thoughts on the government sticking their nose in this?
I don't see that this is a trademark issue. I mean, if you want to be the person that goes out and buys the rights to an offensive name, then you should publicly be the person that gets called out for buying the rights to an offensive name. I don't see why this needs to be a topic of regulation. I don't really have a strong opinion about the name itself, but the point I'd like to make is I don't believe that changing the name would hurt the team. I don't believe that there is a downside to
exactly.
them by doing this. You know, it didn't hurt the DC Bullets when they became the Wizards. It didn't hurt when the New Orleans team became the Pelicans. There is nobody who cares about the Redskins and their following who is going to stop rooting for RG3 if they become the Washington Hamiltonians or whatever.
I just don't know what happens once we change the name. I mean, racism is as American as anything in America. And that doesn't mean we have to suffer it, but by the same token, so that happens, and then what happens?
Well, I think what
you know
happens
what I mean?
Is you stop propagating a racist name. Mm-hmm. That's what happens.
But
it's something that's taken out of the American lexicon, which is always a good thing.
And so what about the Fighting Irish? The Cleveland State
Vikings.
Are
Irish people offended by that, though? Can you have a group of Irish people who say they're offended by that?
This conversation could go on for a very long time, I can tell you, having been in it more than one time. And also, true. I just want to remind people, this is under appeal, and this battle is surely not over. I look forward to hearing the Barbershop talk about it more in the future. You're listening to our weekly Barbershop Roundtable. We're joined by writer Jimmy Israel, healthcare consultant Neil Minkoff, and journalist Corey Dade and Ahmad Omar. Back to you, Jimmy, and I want to move on to the NBA.
Okay, well, you're the boss of me, AC. So, you want to talk about the NBA now the season's over? You know, some great sneakers on the court. I'll say that because I'm probably the only sneaker dude here.
Nah, but, don't do that. Whoa, don't easy. Do that.
Wow, well, fighting words apparently.
Yo, apparently, wow. I'll come the razors. So, Dr. Neil, you you think this could be the craziest off season ever? Why is that?
There's the potential for so much flux. There are so many deals of player contracts that are coming up or players that have the option to test free agency at the same time. So Kevin Garnett and Tim Duncan are both potentially retiring. That's only two of the top, you know, six forwards that ever played. So KG could leave a big hole for the net, or Tim Duncan could leave a big hole for the Spurs. But, oh, Chris Bosh is a free agent, and, oh, so is Dwayne Wade. You have the new ownership of the Clippers, Steve Ballmer, who certainly has the funds and wants to make a splash that he could ignore the salary cap tax and bring Carmelo Anthony, have them join up with Chris Paul and Blake Griffin to be the new big three. The Nets could do the same thing. And, oh, yeah, only the best basketball player in the world could opt out of his deal this year, too. And LeBron hasn't announced what he's doing yet next. So anything could happen. There could be, you know, in a month, the odds of who's going to win the title next year could be 100% different.
I'm so sad to hear that you don't have any passion about this topic.
Isn't it sad that I have so much?
The thing is, there's a lot of speculation about where Miami Heat's LeBron James will end up next. Here's what he said after the finals about his amigos, Dwayne Wade and Chris Bosh, and any potential newbies. Drop that tape, please.
I don't know what Dwayne right now is thinking. I don't know what Chris is thinking right now, you know, but, you know, we'll see what happens. I don't even know who the unrestricted, restricted, early ETOs, whatever the case may be, guys are. I haven't even dug into that.
Dr. Neil knows, though. You can tell.
Yeah, it doesn't sound like this will be decision part two. Corday, CD, what are the chances Carmelo Anthony will put out a different sneaker, much less replace one of the Heat's big three?
I don't think the chances are good. I think, you know, Derek Fisher and his credibility now as the coach of the New York Knicks, you know, his job, number one, is securing Carmelo. Without Carmelo, they don't have a building block for that team on the court. You know, I think, and also if they lose Carmelo, they don't get anything for him, and they can't really afford that. They get cap space, but they wouldn't be able to get anything else.
Sure,
because no one's going to come there sight unseen to be the you know, the starting point. Amari Stoudemire's back, but they may do the amnesty deal and let him go, or let him resign for a cheaper price, so it doesn't hit them on the cap. But I don't see Carmelo going anywhere. I think what's more realistic is LeBron staying where he is, and them, the three of them collectively staying, and them restructuring their deal to make some serious moves on free agency. They know that. Mm-hmm. They know they have to. And the Heat have already proven that they're willing to do anything. They're willing to do anything to keep that team together and keep winning. And the message that Pat Riley's already told LeBron is, if you leave here, you're sort of running away to build something from scratch. You will not have it like this. Lightning doesn't strike twice. He's not going to be able to go somewhere and have this big three kind of dynamic again.
Except the Clippers.
Yeah, well, I'm a Pistons fan, so, you know, free agency is not necessarily the Pistons' strong suit, because attracting people to Auburn Hills, Michigan doesn't work quite as well as South Beach for whatever reason. So we're not getting any of these guys, let's be honest. I'm hoping we do see a decision part two. Put LeBron up, do the ESPN thing, do a whole hour-long special that he got skewered for last time, do it again, because at the end of the day, it's a 29-year-old, 30-year-old playing sports to entertain us. That's the entertainment I'm going to get out of it. I hope to see a big old spectacle, and then whatever team he picks, everyone's going to be mad at him for it, and that's what's going to happen.
Don't hold your breath on that one.
Where he's going.
That ain't
going to
happen,
only. I hope it does, man. That'd be so good.
It's not going to happen.
All right, gentlemen, we want to get your take on one more thing, all right? the lead I've got here, from choppers to crotch rockets. I don't know if that's appropriate. Most motorcycles are all about the power, but Harley-Davidson is hoping to reach a new set of consumers with, get this, an electric Harley, right? Like the Prius of Harleys. What are you laughing at?
I am saying that.
Does it come with a tote bag?
I know it sounds like an oxymoron, but Neil Minkoff, I understand that you like the idea.
I think it's a cool idea. I think it's an incredibly risky idea. I mean, the Harley is synonymous with being big and noisy and the symbol of, you know, getting on the road in freedom, and this is small and nimble and only goes 50 miles and is going to be quiet. But electric motorcycles have been a growing market for some time. The technology is really cool. In many ways, they make a little more sense in terms of, you know, you don't need as much power to push the motorcycle as you do a car. And Harley's doing this in a really intelligent way. They've only made one or two, and they're going to take them all over the country and get user feedback and see if this is a market they want to tap into. But this could be a whole new... It could be a brand new expansion and change how we think of Harleys and being, you know, green, or it could be the new Coca motorcycles.
Crickets on that.
Well, you know, I'm a diamonds in the back sun rooftop digging the lean with a gangster lean type dude. A hashtag William Devon reference. So I'm not really that donor cycle type dude. You're not gonna see me on anybody's motorcycle. Now you might see me in somebody's Cutlass Classic. You know, but I mean, but otherwise, I'm not the dude on two wheels.
You're so Midwest,
Jimmy. I'm with you, Jimmy.
I really am.
I need a steel cage. I need a steel cage separating me from the other cars on the road. So I probably won't be. But the people that would know, the executive director of the Motorcycle Museum Hall of Fame, said it sounds like a jet engine going by you really fast.
So they create a sound for it?
Jet engines are a cool sound.
I've heard about this for electric cars, right, where they give you some kind of simulation engine sound.
And motorcycle riders, you know, they do it for the feel of control, the feel of the rumble of the engine. You know, it's something that Harley has to do. It's more of protecting sort of their place in the market. And there's no rush on it. This will always be a niche product. Motorcycles are a niche product to begin with. Mm-hmm. The classic motorcycle consumer is not practical to begin with. That's why they have motorcycles. So getting to an electric motorcycle is a little bit even more impractical. You know, it's something that they're going to spend a little money on and promote it, but, you know, it's not going to be a game changer anytime soon.
It might be in 20 years from now.
Exactly, 20 years from now.
Jimmy, you were knocking it, but does it make a difference that it's Harley, right? I mean, it's a brand that is tied to manliness and,
No, Harley's not tied in. Cutlass Classic is tied to manliness. I don't know where you're from, Artie, but where I'm from, off 143rd and Hayden, you ride that
Cutty. This is the 1970s, right?
This is last week. Are you serious? You ride the Cutty. That's how we do it here in the Midwest. Shout out to Cleveland.
All right. Well, Jimmy Israel is a writer. You can find his blog at jimmyisrael.com. Jimmy, thanks so much.
Yeah!
Ahmad Omar is an NPR editor with Morning Edition. Thank you, Ahmad.
Thank you.
Neil Minkoff is a healthcare consultant and contributor to the National Review Online and NBA free agent expert. Thanks so much, Neil. And Corey Date is a contributing editor for The Root and runs their political blog, The Take. Corey, thanks for coming in.
Yes, sir. Yes, ma'am.
Remember, if you can't get enough of Barbershop Buzz on the radio, look for the Barbershop Podcast. That's in the iTunes Store or at npr.org. And that's our program for today. I'm Audie Cornish, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News and the African American Public Radio Consortium. Tune in for more talk on Monday.